Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today is going to be a little different program. This is something we've done in the past because either a guest doesn't show up or for some other reason we wanted to do it with me alone, fielding your questions about healthcare issues. So our phone lines are open, our emails are ready to be received for your questions about health and healthcare related issues. I'll do my best to answer your question today. Please remember I'm a pediatrician. I have special interests, however, not only on just about any aspect of pediatric age group issues, but asthma, allergy, and eczema. I enjoy reading and trying to understand our healthcare changes and economics. I have a particular interest in and belief that science is the way we learn how we really know what we know, and I've developed a more recent interest in a realm of science called cognitive psychology, which helps us understand a lot of the hidden biases and problems and ineptitudes of our brain, which we think is so perfect, but sometimes leads us to make very bad decisions. I'm particularly interested in how that affects decisions in healthcare. This type of program will only work if you call or email us. It's difficult to sit on the air on a live program and just keep talking. So let me give you a couple of ways to get a hold of us today. My local number, or I should say the Line 1 local number, is 550-8433, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1, and as you probably know, you spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. Again, the local number, 550-8433, our email, line1@alaskapublic.org. Topics that I think might be of some interest, and I will try to cover if we don't get questions about it, is vitamin D, gluten, measles, and peanut allergy. There's been a recent report on perhaps a way to stem the rising tide of peanut allergy. Before I go to those, I do have one email I'm going to address. This came in from a listener before the program, and I'll read it, the whole email. How do we sort out good information from the hype, pseudoscience, and commercial books and diets? As a layman, it does require some expertise in the field. Recently, the food pyramid has changed. Some fats are good. Gluten-free is a new buzzword. Books like The Grain Brain is a bestseller and promotes eating more protein and says grains are bad for you and your brain. Change is good. A new real science keeps us moving forward in the quest for good health. What are my comments? Well, there's a number of issues here, and I'll just try to go through the points that the writer made and give you my off-the-cuff comments. It is true that the food pyramid has been changed, and any time there's changes like this, to some people, it raises the question that science is not helping us. But what I want to remind everybody is that science is constantly, what makes it so effective is it's constantly challenging the assumed beliefs from prior testing, and it became clear that there have been some errors and biases in previous studies, looking particularly at fats. Some of the studies looking at how fats might be bad for us were done at a time when there was a lot more people smoking, both of which are high fat intake and smoking, which are bad for hearts. And re-looking at some of that data and newer data since the previous guidelines, it's my understanding that now there's some loosening of these recommendations about the kinds of fats that we eat and what quantity, and that perhaps it's only certain segments of the population where some of the fat intake is significant. I'm not prepared to make any further comments about the food pyramid changes. I may be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure I'm right about the fact that I'm glad that science is willing to keep looking at what we assume is correct and making changes as frustrating as it is as we learn more information. The other comment that was brought up by the writer was gluten-free is a buzzword. Gluten is a huge issue. It seems like most physicians like myself run into people on a daily basis that think they have gluten problems, and gluten is a relatively common problem, but not nearly as common as people think it is. Gluten is a protein that's in barley and wheat and rye and occasionally in some oats. True gluten enteropathy or celiac disease is a very significant medical problem and can be associated with an increased risk of cancer. People who think they feel better because they're off gluten might be causing themselves to have some nutritional deficiency. So it's reasonable to get that diagnosis feeling good. It's very hard to take the bias out of a study. If you're the only person in the study and you've decided you're going to take gluten out, it's very likely by doing something you're going to tell yourself that you feel better. And that's not the point here. So there is a blood test that is fairly accurate and a good, reliable screen. It's easy to do. Other problems with gluten would include wheat allergy. Celiac disease is not really an allergy. It's what's called an autoimmune disease due to the ingestion of gluten. The lining of the intestinal tract begins to react against itself, and so removing gluten can solve that inflammation. Wheat allergy is the body's response against a wheat protein that can cause allergic symptoms, including vomiting, diarrhea, cramping, abdominal pain, maybe even rash. So there are different issues. Both would respond to removing gluten from the diet, however. And there may be some other issues. There's a particular problem with some people who eat grains. A lot of grains, in particular beans, some vegetables, have quite a bit of carbohydrate. If you're unable to break down the carbohydrate completely, you may have more gas, more distension, more bloating, a tendency towards diarrhea. Much like people with lactose deficiency that have trouble with milk and breaking down the carbohydrate, lactose in milk. So these people that have this difficulty when they go on a gluten-free diet may remove a lot of the food sources that are causing this bloating and so forth, and they may feel better. Again, getting the right diagnosis and the right nutritional consult would be important to make sure you're not going to be nutritional deficient. But that problem is not truly a celiac disease and responds to a particular diet, which has a funny name. I'm going to give you that diet. It's called the FODMAP diet, F-O-D-M-A-P. And a good place to look it up if you think this fits you is go to Stanford, S-T-A-N-F-O-R-D, FODMAP, F-O-D-M-A-P diet. It's a very reliable source of information about trying this diet that may help you. And is not a diet designed specifically for gluten-free. Another issue that the writer brings up is books like The Food Grain, or The Grain Brain, is a bestseller, promotes eating more protein, and says grains are bad for you and your brain. There is a tremendous amount of, and this was a bestseller, he says, there's a lot of books that make it into the bestseller list that are really not very valid information. Sources for valid information and checking the information you may see about any bestseller. And please remember, one of the good fallacies you want to remember, just because somebody famous, somebody important says something, it doesn't make it right. And a good place that I go to for nutritional information is the Harvard School of Public Health. I look up their nutritional source information. And often check their other major universities' nutritional sources are usually fairly reliable and worth double checking against. And then I always like to go to quackwatch.com to look up authors of various and sundry bestsellers and popular bits of information, because they often show up on that list, and they at quackwatch.com do a very good job of trying to vet the knowledge and past history of different people selling and promoting things. In general, people who are trying to sell and promote things should raise some level of suspicion as a general rule as well. I am not aware that eating more protein is better for us and that grains are necessarily bad for our brain. There's been quite a bit of recent discussion about brain health, and I made a comment on the last program about a recent Stanford University recommendation about things that have been shown to be good for your brain. And it really boils down to exercise, eat good, eat sensibly, lose weight, but particularly exercise is the things that we know may be beneficial for your brain. So I hope that helps answer that that question for the listener who wrote that email. We have a couple of good calls already, and that certainly makes me feel good, makes it easier for me to keep going here. We're going to take our next call. Max, you're on line one. What can I try to help you with?
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks. And your show is a great one, and we really always enjoy it.
Oh, thank you.
I'm approaching 70 years old. I'm a veteran of the military, Southeast Asia, been around lots of noise all my life. And I have what's called tinnitus. It's not been formally diagnosed. It's just that I have a tone that I can hear all the time.
Right.
The last time I took my physical at my doctor, who's my regular doctor here in town, he asked me if it kept me awake and did it interfere with my, life and all this kind of stuff. And I told him no, but it does kind of keep me awake sometimes. And I'm curious about are there hearing aids that can be tuned to a certain frequency and create white noise that eliminate it, or do hearing aids just amplify the sounds around you, therefore making everything else loud and muddled at the same time? What's the result of trying to improve better hearing and get rid of tinnitus?
All right, so I'm going to answer that by saying I don't know. I want certain things. I want people to be sure they hear, and that's one of them. Tinnitus is common. It's particularly suggest involvement of the auditory nerve, problems with the nerve, and certainly your exposures to loud noises and maybe aging. But there are a number of factors that can lead to this. And so my answer would be, if it's mild and wasn't bothering you a lot, maybe I wouldn't worry so much. But if it's beginning to really affect you and you're having problems, my advice would be to see an ear, nose, and throat specialist who run into this every day and can certainly give you good answers on what's available. But what's available and what you should do will depend on getting a good diagnosis of why you in particular are having that problem.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
You bet.
Your day goes smooth.
Thanks, Max. Have a good day yourself.
Bye-bye.
Let me remind listeners again, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection, and today we're doing a little different program that sometimes is stressful for me. It's stressful not because I like to answer questions that people call. It's stressful because if you don't call, it's hard for somebody on live radio to keep talking for an hour. So if you've got questions or comments that you would like me to try to answer or steer you in the right direction to get some good answers, let me give you some ways to contact me over the next hour. Our email address is line1. L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local phone number, I should say, is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. I particularly am more likely to help you if we stick with pediatrics, vitamin D issues, maybe measles, peanut allergy. There's been some stuff about science and how we know what we know or things that I'm particularly interested in. But I will do my best for whatever you have a question about. So let's go on. We got one here about toddler allergy. That sounds like one right up my best knowledge. So let's see what Jessica has to ask. Jessica, what can I do for you?
Hi. I have a 15-month-old who was recently diagnosed through the scratch test with cat allergy. And he's on a regimen right now of I think, cetirizine in the morning and then hydroxyzine in the evening. So on some antihistamines, he responds really well to it. But I'm just curious that's something that our allergist told us he'd probably be on until maybe he turns 5 and we can talk about allergy shots. So what are the long-term, if any, effects of being on antihistamines for little guys?
Right. So anytime we talk about any treatment, I think it's extremely important that everybody ask at least two questions of yourself and your provider, and that's what's the risk of the treatment and what's the risk of not treating. And with allergies, you very much have to have an individualized discussion with each individual, which is probably true in almost all situations. So there is a lot of variability in the amount of symptoms that animal dander allergies will cause. Some people may have a positive skin test to a cat, as you said your son did, and they may sleep with that cat and they may have a stuffy nose. Other people will have a positive skin test, perhaps exactly the same size. They get into a car with someone who owns a cat. There is no cat in that car. It's a closed space, but there's dander on the people's clothing and maybe in that car, and they will start wheezing and perhaps have a life-threatening reaction. So the testing tells you you are sensitized. It says you're at risk. You really have to talk to people to see how much trouble those things that they're sensitized to are really causing them. In your case, it's been recommended to use an antihistamine. And if a young child is having lots of ear trouble, cough, it's affecting sleep and so forth, it should be a very, very safe long-term treatment. Most of the antihistamines today that are recommended are like cetirizine, which is Zyrtec, and Claritin, which is loratadine. For all intents and purposes, get rid of one major side effect, and that's sedation, like which is happens with Benadryl. Hydroxyzine is also quite can make you quite sleepy. So. And it's been, I guess it was recommended to be used at night to perhaps help sleep. So those are side effects that, particularly for people that are driving cars, it's not recommended to take those kinds of medications. And for kids in school, it's much better to be taking the Zyrtec, cetirizine, loratadine, which is also Claritin-like products, because they're very, very much less likely to cause sedation. Other than that, I don't think there's any very likely significant side effects from long-term use. But clearly, again, you have to make that decision on whether you're going to use them, depending on whether you can avoid the cat, how much symptoms your son's having, and perhaps even age. That make sense?
Yeah, thanks.
All right. Good luck with that.
All right, thanks.
The immunotherapy is an option. Usually in many parts of the country, it's a series of shots that are designed to try to basically fuel your immune system into thinking you are not allergic, and it is much more effective than it used to be in the past, particularly in people are just allergic to one particular or two particular things is where it's most effective. I've got another call. Let's go ahead and take that. Lisa, you're on line one.
Hi, I'm calling about my six-year-old daughter. She was diagnosed with a thyroglossal duct cyst when she was around two. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are as far as, does it need to be removed or can a child have it and just, live with it?
Right.
What are your thoughts?
Typically what I would do with a thyroglossal duct cyst is have an ear, nose, and throat specialist take a look and see what they think. I think the general rule is to try to go ahead and fix those. There's perhaps an increased likelihood of infection in those. You could get an infected, like an abscess. Another thing that I think about with thyroglossal duct cyst is thyroid problems. Sometimes because embryologically this problem is related to the time the thyroid gland was being developed and put into its normal place. It can be in an unusual place. And so knowing a little bit about what's going on with your thyroid gland at the same time is often in, something that's done as an investigation. But generally, I think the feeling is it's better to get these things taken care of, particularly if you're younger.
Okay. Okay. And if you don't mind me asking, she also happens to be on allergy immunotherapy.
Right.
This is a secondary question, but I was wondering, she's now on a month-to-month regimen, so she's progressed quite well. At what point do you think it's okay to start reintroducing them? Like, one of her allergens is horses, and she really wants to take horseback riding lessons. Mm-hmm. Should one wait, or maybe just test it out and see how she reacts? Is there a general rule of thumb?
Right. Yeah. I'm not a board certified allergist, but I would tell you, I think you do want to see things. I mean, the reason for the testing, I would argue, or the immunotherapy you went through, is to try to decrease her likelihood of having a response. And mm-hmm. so the classic answer is you do it in somebody who's a veterinary physician, because you want to help them not have so many symptoms on their job. And in this case, you were probably trying to do this to decrease his symptoms, so perhaps she could get back to doing some things and be exposed to some animals that she was having trouble with in the past. So I think a slow kind of mm-hmm. Exposure again to those things should be something worthwhile. There's with inhalant allergens, there's not the general risk of like food allergens where you may have anaphylaxis. There's no question that sometimes animal danders might trigger an asthma attack, but I think if you're cautious, you notice if you're starting to have respiratory symptoms and you get away from the situation, it should be a safe thing to try.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You bet. Good luck, Lisa. Let me remind listeners again, this is Line 1, Your Health Connection. We're coming to you from Anchorage, Alaska. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard, your host. And today we're doing a program that we don't do very often. It's where I try to open the phone lines and emails for questions about medical issues, medical economics, how we know what we know, so to speak, and try to answer your questions. If you would like to try to get in touch with me about a question, let me give you a couple of ways to do that. Our local number, 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. I have an email that's come in again, and I'm going to have to read this because while I'm answering questions on the phone, it's very difficult for me to try to read the email at the same time. So I'm going to read this and then see if I can answer a question. It says, I've seen a rise in genealogic testing, family tree, DNA, ancestry.com, and so forth that are not FDA approved. There are tools out there for people who can run their results through and obtain associations with studies so far published on markers they contain. Are you seeing patients bringing these in, and do you at this point put any weight into them into suggestions that suggest a marker that have put them at higher risk of disease or having a particular drug interaction? I would have to say that to date, the genetic information that we are acquiring about health issues particularly has yet to be specifically helpful. It does raise questions about risk. However, there's a long way between having that risk and the onset of disease in many illnesses and many markers. And I think each one as we go forward is going to have to be looked at particularly. Huntington's disease is one where there is, in my understanding, a pretty high risk if you've got that you're going to develop that illness. Another one we hear a lot about is the BRCA1 and 2 genes that are associated with breast and ovarian cancers in women. And it is not necessarily you have the genes, you'll develop the problem. There are variants in these genes. There are what we call epigenetic influences, things in the environment. So one of the things the FDA has done is tried to stop this idea that people can send in blood and get information on diseases, because it is so complex and we don't want people making irrational and uninformed decisions about healthcare issues. If you want to follow up where your family tree is, that's a whole different issue, and I don't see any big problems. I think it's been very helpful. So if you've done some blood testing independently and you have some markers, gotten information that suggests you may have certain risks, I strongly recommend that you see a genetic counselor or a geneticist before doing anything about that to see what's really known and what your true risks might really be. So hopefully that is helpful on that question. We've got another question on the radio or on the telephone here. I'm going to take Russell. Russell, you're on line one.
Good afternoon, Dr. Woodard.
Howdy.
Hey, I'm calling on behalf of my wife, and she unfortunately has what's been defined as Radon's disease, and I may be slaughtering that a little bit. It's where her fingers and toes go cold.
It's Raynaud's, R-A-Y-N-A-U-D-N-D-A-S, Raynaud's disease, yes.
Okay, here's the problem. She takes a glass of water with ice water.
Yep.
Her fingers go white,
yep.
Absolutely white, like she's right out of the morgue.
Yeah. Well, hopefully not, yeah, but I understand it can be pretty painful, too.
Well, it's like fingers falling asleep.
Yep.
And so we have hand warmers that we crank out, give to her, works them a little bit, and the fingers go right back. But it's come to the point where she can barely go outside without this taking place now. And I've bought gloves, electric gloves, electric docks, and as long as we keep the heat going, she can do it. But go for a walk, she takes her hand out of her gloves, 10 seconds, her hands are white.
Right. So this, in my experience, I don't see this in pediatrics too much, although I have seen it in friends, and I've seen it in parents, and I'm aware of it. It does happen in children. It's a vasospasm. I think it's thought to be in the relationship to an autoimmune-like phenomenon. We used to see it more in people who smoke quite a bit, and certainly smoking it would not be recommended. And then most people would try to do things like you've been doing without medications, but there are medications that have been helpful. And it sounds to me, if you look at this risk-benefit ratio, if it's getting to that point, a good investigation by somebody knowledgeable in this to see if we can figure out exactly what the reason is and or go ahead and start some treatments would be recommended. I'm struggling a little bit on the top of my head about who I would have see her, except I know there's probably you would get good advice at there's a local group of allergists and immunologists in town. They all work together, and they certainly would see illnesses suggestive of this. Also, another group would be rheumatologists. They see a lot of this kind of thing. So a primary care physician who is not as experienced, you might go to see if you can get a referral or see if you can get into one of those two offices, which usually requires some kind of referral.
All right. Well, GPs usually have not a whole lot of information.
Yep. Well, it's a real problem, and it can be treated, or there might be some investigations to help figure out exactly why she's having the problem and address it from that way as well.
Yeah, it is genetic, though. It's her mother has it, her brother has it, our children have it.
Wow.
So it's following down the family tree there.
Yep. I'd go see one of the rheumatologists or the allergists if it's that big of a – if it's in the family history that much.
Okay, rheumatologist it is. Thank you very much.
All right. You have a good day.
Yep. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Got a number of emails. That's good to see from my point of view, and we're already halfway through the program. I'm going to take one that's on molluscum contagiosum. It says, my family doctor diagnosed a 10-year-old with molluscum contagiosum on the inner thigh. He's starting wrestling practice. Besides two pairs of shorts, are there any precautions we should take? Also, wrestling a bad idea until the bumps go away. He could miss the whole season. Molluscum contagiosum is a wart. It's just a funny-looking wart, and if you express it, it looks like a little pimple. And if you take a really good look and they're big enough, they'll look like they have a little dimple in the very top of that little pimple. But some of them are bigger than others and easier to see that some aren't. If you express everything out of that lesion, it'll go away. So one of the treatments is just to kind of express them or to kind of take a sharp instrument and break off the top. And they'll bleed a little bit more than you think are necessary because there is some vascular component to it, but it's really not dangerous. Covering them is makes sense. Since they're caused by a virus, they are contagious. We'll often see kids who have eczema spread them by itching. And if they're on the elbow, they'll have mirror lesions on the other side of the inner elbow where they flex their arm, so clearly they can be contagious. If there's not very many, getting rid of a couple of them may help. There's lots of medications that have been tried. If you got any Retin A, anything that's used for or certain products that are used for acne, if you put a little bit of that on them consistently, sometimes you can make these things go away. Or you can have somebody just remove them. If you don't want to do that, I think it's perfectly reasonable to wear just cover up the lesions and keep wrestling as best you can. These are not dangerous. They can spread, however. So that would be, I guess, my off-the-cuff advice on a wrestler with molluscum contagiosum. All right, we are, believe it or not, halfway through this program. Our local number again, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, and I'll take a look at all these emails and see if we can't answer some more questions. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Thad Woodard, Dr. Thad Woodard, your host for Line 1, your health connection on KSKA, coming from you in Anchorage, Alaska. Today I'm fielding healthcare questions and kind of doing my best to help. And if I can't give you reliable answers, I'll do my best to give you a reliable resource. Our email for questions today is line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. If you're listening to this program and it's between 9 and 10 on Monday evenings, this is a taped rebroadcast you're listening, so we won't, or I won't, be able to answer your questions at that time. A couple of emails, and then I have someone holding on the line. This question says, the transgender community repeatedly runs into problems receiving both primary care and transitional care. Providers frequently lack both medical and social competency, such as using the wrong pronouns. This creates an atmosphere where people self-medicate and delay seeking medical care. Any ideas on how we can change the healthcare climate to locally improve the quality of healthcare? It is an uncommon issue for physicians to experience questions like this. That is not an excuse. It's just the realism of it, and we're better at what we do all the time. There are providers that are trying to become much more astute in this. Our office has just had an hour-long lunch about how we can be better at addressing transgender issues and understanding transgender the community, and to use the wrong pronouns, which I believe it's even difficult within the transgender community to also always know how a person wants to be referred to. So I don't have a great answer other than experience and continuing to look or ask friends who have had some experience, but there is an increasing awakening of the need to address these issues and problems with the transgender community. So I wish you the best of luck, and I hopefully we will get better at that as we have more experience with these issues. I've got another email that says, do I know of a good treatment for fingernail fungus causing yellowing and thickening of the nails? My 87-year-old mother takes great pride in her appearance. It's troubled. First, you want to make sure you've got a right diagnosis, and if the nail is involved by itself and it's not involving the cuticle or around the area, there are some topical preparations now that are available. I think they're all prescription. I may be wrong about that, but there is a very easy, fairly reliable treatment for fungus infections of the fingernails and toenails. It should be a little easier to treat fingernails, particularly if the the cuticle, like I said, is not involved. If it's involving the whole nail and particularly back into the cuticle, it often takes some oral treatment, which is a little bit more difficult to do. My advice would be go ahead and see a primary care physician. They should be able to help with this if you haven't done so. And if they can't, then certainly the dermatologists in town should be able to help this this problem be resolved without too much difficulty and not much risk. One more question. This is an email that came in. My 11-year-old daughter decided at age 7 she wants to be a vegetarian. She eats eggs, fish, milk, and olive oil in cooking, as well as beans and rice. She also takes gummy bear vitamins. Is there anything that we need to do to make sure she will avoid problems that will affect her growth and development? My understanding is as long as you're not a lacto-ovo-vegetarian, that is, if you're a vegetarian that's eating eggs and fish and milk, you should have no nutritional risks. You should be able to do fine. If you're a lacto-ovo-vegetarian, some of the B vitamin complexes may not be obtained well enough, and you might need some specific vitamin replacement. But I think being a vegetarian, as you described, it should not be a problem. Let's go ahead and take one of the phone calls that I've got also here. I've got Vic on line one. Vic, what can I do for you?
Yeah, I've been on Coumadin for 15 years, and I'm wondering what problems can arise from long-term Coumadin therapy.
Ooh, boy, this is a tough one for me, Vic, because you're not in the age group I deal with, and I don't do Coumadin. Coumadin is a blood thinner, and there's certainly always going to be some risk of problems related to that. I'm going to have to ask you, give you the best advice would be to see somebody else, an internal medicine, adult physician who's dealing with this much more commonly to get a good answer. I do also know there are some newer products available in the right situation. They might be a better choice now if you haven't seen anybody in a while. But I think the most important thing I can tell you is if you haven't talked to somebody in a while about it, to ask somebody who does this regularly, probably a cardiologist or somebody in doing vascular work regularly.
Okay, can I ask another one?
You betcha.
Is there any evidence that gluten can be a migraine trigger?
I'm not aware of that. Anything is possible, but when I nowadays, my understanding of migraine is it's basically a neurologic problem, which causes some headaches, and there's so many possible things that we could maybe trigger it. Most of these don't hold up very well when they're really looked at critically and in controlled ways, and I'm not aware that gluten is a likely trigger for it.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. Let's take another one of our phone calls, and then I'll move back to some emails. Chris, you're on line one.
Hi, Dr. Witter. I just want to say, firstly, thanks for your time, and I really appreciate your show. It's a great thing to have on the radio. So
all right. Well, ask me an easy question then.
I recently developed what I believe is ringworm. So I was wondering if you could tell me. This is about a month ago. I developed a couple of round circles. Looked like what I saw on the internet was ringworm. I'm treating it with an over-the-counter 1% something medication and antifungal cream. But it's pretty stubborn. It doesn't seem to want to go away. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you could tell me just like some basic information about ringworm, at what point I should go see somebody and have it looked at.
Yeah, like well, generally ringworm, where is it on your trunk or your arms or legs or in a more moist area of your body?
It's on my butt cheeks.
Yeah, okay. So first off, In pediatrics, most people who come in with ringworm that I see don't have ringworm. We see a lot of what's called nummular eczema here. Nummular eczema is a coin-like sized lesion, so it's circular, and that's what people associate with ringworm. And it's dry. It usually doesn't itch particularly, but it doesn't. It's not active. It is. It may be the whole area is looks a little dry. Might itch a little bit, but with ringworm, although you have a ring or an area that's usually worsening, the center is usually clear and there's an active border. The outside is a little bit more inflamed, a little bit more red, may itch, so it's clear in the middle and usually changing a little bit. A lot of ringworm does respond to over-the-counter antifungal medications that you can find easily. So when you say it's not responding, it may be that you have kind of nummular eczema lesions that are just getting a barrier kind of thing put on them, and that's why it's not changing. That's I'm a little bit worried about what you really got. If this is going to sound really goofy, but if you take the over-the-counter steroid cream like Cordaid, which you can get, it will help most nummular eczema, and it won't do anything for funguses, and it might make things a little worse. So you got a couple of options. You can trust me and try the steroid. If I make it worse, don't fire me, but go see it. You may need a prescription. But it may be that this is just a little bit of nummular eczema. I'm not sure how often it's seen in adults, but we see it in kids all the time.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you.
All right. Good luck. Got an email. It says, I'm the father of a preschooler who is frequently and continuously ill with sinus and respiratory infections. No immune condition has been diagnosed despite screening and testing. It's been suggested that a type 4 allergy, a food allergy, may be contributing to recurrent infections that stick around longer than siblings and peers. Could you comment on how a food allergy could compromise the immune system to the point they would be more vulnerable to viral infections? Allergy testing is very complicated, and food challenges for a three-year-old are full of subjectivities. Well, this is a common question, and it helps to know a little bit more of the specifics here, but what I can tell you is children in the first couple of years of life average somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 to 12 respiratory infections per year and 2 to 3 episodes of vomiting and diarrhea. Let's just focus on the respiratory illnesses to start with. So if you've got 8 to 12 respiratory illnesses, let's say 10, let's say they average an average of 7 days. So you got 10 times 7, that's 70 days. The average child in the United States is going to have some respiratory symptoms, and it's primarily in the winter, which is only going to last several months. So it's often a problem about trying to determine how much is just normal and how much is not. Having said that, adults who have allergy definitely don't have more infections. They have more complications of the infections they have. In a sense, I tell my parents their respiratory tract is more sensitive, just like people have sensitive skin, because of allergy or because of the genetics, and they often make more mucus. That's the lining of the mucous membranes in your nose and chest do when they're injured, just like your skin will make a scab and itch and burn if it's inflamed. So because of that extra mucus, you are more likely as a young child to have ear and sinus infections and cough, perhaps asthma, so that when you get a cold, it lasts longer and you have more complications. So in general, I wouldn't say that allergy necessarily compromises the immune system. I would almost argue that allergies is a hyped-up immune reaction that is making you more sensitive to have symptoms when you get these colds. And unfortunately, boys seem to have more trouble early a lot of the time than girls do. Allergy testing is extremely complicated, and food challenges particularly are the most likely the best way to tell if you really truly have a food allergy. So I hope that is a little bit helpful, but I hope it clarifies the reason why definitely kids with allergies do appear to have more problems with infections. There has also been some literature recently suggesting that, or demonstrating that, kids who have recurrent ear and sinus problems are not responding to the immunizations that they're given early in life to protect them against some common bacteria that used to cause quite a bit of meningitis, which we don't see anymore, but also seems to be, those same organisms seem to be related to decreasing ear and sinus problems. And when we look at kids who have recurrent otitis, ear infections and sinusitis, many of them have not responded to the immunizations as well. Since your son has had some immune workup, I suspect that's been looked at, however. I don't know. As best I can tell, that's all I can give your information. I hope that's helpful on that particular issue. I've got a question here about autism. If you run out of topic time, it says you. Can I say something about autism? I can say a few things about autism. I think we're definitely screening much more effectively. We're much more aware of it than we've ever been. The diagnostic criteria have changed a number of times over recent periods of time. And because of all of this, I am one of these guys that's a little leery that we're seeing that much more autism. And there are studies that back up this idea that it's better recognition and broader diagnostic classification that may explain a large percentage, if not all, of the apparent increase in autism. I do not know whether we're seeing more autism or not. I'm just skeptical that it's that much heavier. One study that made me think about this that I can think of in particular was a study in England where they took adults and children by 10-year age groups, 1 to 9, 10 to 19, 20 to 29, all the way up, I think, to 60 or 70. So in 10-year increments, they used today's recent diagnostic criteria of individuals they could find in that age group that had what different kinds of illness that was causing significant neurological impairment. And when they did that, in each group, there was roughly about 10% of the population fit today's criteria, including people that were in their 50s and 60s, suggesting that the rate of autism, one, it's been somewhat similar throughout all this period of time, and two, that it can't possibly be due to immunizations alone, since many of the older people were alive before the immunizations were even given. And I am in no way trying to promote the idea that vaccines cause immunizations. If there's anything I think we can say now is all the studies that have been done is it's not immunizations that's causing autism. In fact, the evidence is just building and building and building that there's a significant genetic component. There might be some environmental influences on the genetics that leads to autism, but it's not immunizations, and may not be as increased in prevalence as we might think because of the way we diagnose it and our recognition of it. Another email that seems to be something perhaps I can handle is entitled Worsening Allergies to Fruits and Vegetables, What to Do. So a question that's been shortened by my helpers here in the control room is that what can be done for food allergies other than eliminating foods? I have sensitivities and allergies to lots of fruits and vegetables. And the answer is there's not anything that's safe and effective that's been shown other than avoiding the foods. When I hear about people with lots of food allergies, particularly fruits and vegetables, it's possible that some of these reactions are what are called the oral allergy syndrome, which I think I should make a discussion of, which is somewhat different perhaps than true allergies to nuts and peanuts and shellfish that people hear so much about. So that people, for example, up here often have a lot of birch allergy, and it's well known that people who have different pollen allergies, their immune system is making an antibody, a protein against the birch protein. And it sometimes is confused. Our immune system gets fooled by a protein that might be in peaches, pears, plums, apples, sometimes carrots. And when those foods are eaten without cooking, they will cause itching, particularly in the mouth. If you cook them, because these proteins are heat labile, they break down and you don't have the symptoms. Generally, that is just a bothersome symptom. It's not dangerous, but the really best allergists I know don't like to tell people they should continue to eat those foods, although the risk of serious problem is very, very low. But it's a slightly different issue than what we see with true nut and shellfish allergies, for example. Another question on the same email is, what are the reasons for increased food sensitivities and allergies? Itchy throat, mouth, and lips, somewhat like I just described. Over time, since I was 20 years of old, now at 45, I am adding new foods I'm allergic to at an annual basis. Now, listening to this email, I think the person that's writing it is becoming more and more allergic to pollens and danders. And it even been noticed with things like latex, there can be cross-reactions to bananas and I think avocados or some things. So I suspect the person who's written this is becoming more allergic to other inhaled allergens and is noticing the oral allergy syndrome. And I can't answer why it's happening at your age. It is what makes allergies so unpredictable and enigmatic. But I believe your story, and I suspect that the answer is you're having more inhalant allergens and, in addition, some cross-reaction between your immune response to various and sundry food allergens. Let me try to take another email here. This is an email that says, do you have any recommendations for MDs who also have knowledge and expertise in alternative Chinese non-Western medicine in Anchorage? And unfortunately, my answer to that is off the top of my head, I don't. I've heard of a few anesthesiologists who have dabbled with acupuncture, but the Chinese Western medicine I can't help you with, so I'll have to defer on that question. There's another question, and unfortunately, as fast as this time is going, there are more emails that I'm going to get to. I'm going to apologize ahead of time, but I'm going to do my best on what we got left here. This is a question revolving a toddler or an infant with difficulty with pain and swallowing. It says, are you aware of any long-term effects on children having additives like Thicket added to their diet? Do you have a recommendation on what else we might try for other consideration? It seems like this is an issue common with the elderly. Background, I have a 15-month-old who's been diagnosed as a chronic aspirator or dysphagia. She has aspiration and pneumonia four times now despite her best effort to control it. She's had swallow studies and sees a speech and feeding therapist and has thus found no identified structural. They hope she'll allow structural problem. They hope she'll outgrow it. So they've been using Thicket, which is a product that is added to the diet to add some consistency, with the idea that the less more like a gruel or an oatmeal liquids, it may be easier or harder for things to be brought back up from your esophagus into the back of your throat, where you could accidentally aspirate it into your lungs. And the answer to the question is, I don't know of any significant long-term side effects. Often other foods have been tried to be added. I think it's a significant problem if you're having aspiration pneumonia, and I would strongly think, without a lot of expertise, that Thicket is far safer than aspiration, and would encourage you to continue to do that if that indeed is helping. One other question I'm going to try here. My six-year-old has high calcium and high blood protein. What causes this? He does not have Williams syndrome. Williams syndrome is a genetic disorder associated sometimes with high calcium. You got me on this one. There's a number of things associated with high calcium. But I'm having trouble with the high blood protein association, so I have to apologize if the answer, since you know about Williams syndrome, I assume you've probably been talking to a pediatrician about this. We are shortly going to have an endocrinologist up and a new one. We've been short of a pediatric endocrinologist. That might be a reasonable referral for this problem, or even a geneticist who we have come up quarterly from, I think Portland is where they're coming from now, the University of Oregon, maybe two sources of information about this. This is not the kind of thing I think you're going to figure out on the internet. I often tell my patients the internet's a great place to go when you know the diagnosis and you're looking for options, but it's a very bad place to be when you're trying to figure out a diagnosis, because there's so many things that can cause some of these issues, and there's not much on the internet that puts them in perspective and relative frequency. Here's a book. This is the foreword is the Grain Brain. So please read the book before suggesting Dr. Pollmerder is a quack. I never said Dr. Pollmerder is a quack. I've never read the book. I have no idea whether Dr. Pollmerder is a quack or not. I think I said that I think there's limited information on what is helpful for brains and what is harmful for brains. He may be exactly right. According to what, there's a long email that I've got, he has a large a degree here, and he might be exactly right. I apologize if someone thought I called him a quack. I did not, that I can recall. But I do encourage people, nevertheless, to always check on these things, and often books that are up for sale are somebody's opinion. What we really want is consensus opinion by experts, and I certainly think it's worthwhile to look around about what Dr. Perlmutter is recommending about what we eat as far as health for the grain for the brain. Again, he might be right. I don't know anything about it. All right. I have to say I very much appreciate everybody's efforts to call and email, and I hope I've helped a few people a little bit, and I'm not in the business of doing them harm, so I don't want to have done that. If you felt like you've had some good information given to you, it's my thanks very much for taking the time to call, and I hope it was helpful. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can join us at KSK on Facebook, and you can find that link on our website, which is www.alaskapublic.org. You can also find our Line 1 archives at that link, and you can leave thoughts and suggestions about this program or other ideas for programs that you would like to have us do. Beginning March 30th, KAKM-TV is going to air for three consecutive nights Ken Burns' new documentary on the history of cancer. This is based on Siddhartha Mukherjee's book, The Emperor of All Maladies, which I read several years ago and is an excellent, excellent read. This should be a great documentary. To follow up on this theme about cancer, our next program will discuss colon cancer, in particular the epidemiology. Who gets it? When do they get it? What are the risks? And screening with the epidemiologist, Dr. Diana Redwood, who is with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, and family physician, Dr. Heidi Barnes of the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center. So why don't you join us and learn more next Monday, March 23rd. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Evan Erickson is our web editor and audio engineer today. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.